Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
And I'm delighted to welcome now in our Cork studio the reigning Cork Person of the Year, as it happens, broadcaster and author John Creedon. How are you, John?
I'm only the warm in the seat for you, Brendan. You're next. No, I'm doing great. Thanks, Brendan, and thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
No, it's pleasure to have you. So, John, and the reason you're here is you've written and put together a book, An Irish Folklore Treasury. But I suppose it's about our connectedness with the past. But I noticed as well reading it that it kind of caused you to look back a bit on your own life and your family and your past as well, didn't it? To tell the listeners, maybe in a short form, that story you start with about that day with your father.
Oh, yeah, that's in the introduction. In effect, what this is, by the way, just to set the scene for the book, new state, Irish Free State, 1921, of course, we had lost public records with the shelling of the four courts. And in fairness to the founding fathers and founding mothers of the state, they were quite brilliant, I think, because in 1935, they set up the Folklore Commission. And by 37, they had 50,000 children with the help of the INTO and the Department of Education, all with brand new shiny copybooks collecting the folklore of Ireland. So that's what the project was.
And we'll talk plenty collection. About the book.
Sorry.
But tell me about Connie Creedon.
About my dad.
Yeah.
My old man was a gas character, really. He really was. He spoke Latin, classical Greek. He was a native Irish speaker, spoke Beryl as well. And I went off to Westport one weekend with him. And on the way back, I brought him out to see Croagh Patrick. I said, seems that it's named after you. Connie Patrick was his name. And he said to me, he was impressed, but he said, we're heading home now, are we? And I said, one last thing, if you wouldn't mind, Dad, I just want to bring you across the road to have a look at the installation by John Behan, the famine memorial there by John Behan, the sculptor. And he wasn't hugely impressed. He said, oh, God, do I have to get out of the car again at my age? I said, just have one peep at this, Dad. So he did. And I saw him going quiet, and not unlike myself. He was a man who had 60 words per minute with occasional gusts of 80. But I noticed he kind of went into himself. He was walking around and squinting at it. And it's an amazing bronze galleon. You're probably familiar with it. It's about 16th size coffin ship and skeletal figures on the masts and raggy sails. And it's pointing westwards towards America. And I could see he was kind of taken in by it. But as we headed back to Cork, he hadn't spoken for about an hour, which would be unusual for my dad or for me. But I looked over once or twice to see had he fallen asleep. And eventually I said to him, I said, what do you think the people from the famine would... Oh, no, he said to me, he said, geez, he said they had it very hard, because I'd asked him what he was thinking about. He said, the people in the famine. And I said, what do you think they'd make of us, you know, with the Celtic Tiger and winning independence eventually and everything else? Geez, he said, I don't know anything about that. He said, but I knew a man who was in the famine. I said, Dad, you couldn't have known a man who was in the famine. The famine was 150 years ago. And he said, well, I'm telling you now, I did know a man in the famine. And I said, well, go on. I said, tell me, who was your man? He said, when I was a little boy, his father had Model T trucks. They owned a mill in Inchigila. And he said, when I was a little boy, from the time I was 5 or 6, I used to go off with Dinis Lucy, he said, in the Model T truck delivering meal around West Cork. And there was a man called Sullivan living near Glengariff who lived right into his 90s. And I remember him telling us not once, but several times a story. He said that when he was a little boy around Glengariff, the famine was raging back west along. And he said the Bantry Workhouse used to send out what the people then called an ambulance. But he said what it actually was a pony and crib, a wicker cart, to collect the dead and the dying and bring them back into the Bantry Workhouse. And he said, I went skipping down the street with the other children, he said, and I had a little sally rod, and I was pushing it in through the wicker, trying to poke a dead man who was inside in the back of the cart. And the man wasn't dead at all. He was alive, and he had the strength to push away the stick. And he said, although I was only a small child when I did that, he said, it's to my immortal shame that I did such a terrible thing. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, he said, he told me that story. Not once, he said, several times he told us that story. And yeah. I said, how come you never told me? He said, you never asked me. As if it was my fault, you know. But the moral of the story is, ask, yeah.
Yeah, and also that, like, all this stuff is not in living memory, but definitely 2-3 degrees of separation. And I think, you know, when you look at a lot of the folklore in the book, in many ways, it's not that long ago, but a very different country. Like, I was even struck that, like, you're a little bit older than me now, but you, it sounds like you grew up in a very different Cork to what I did. Like, you remember there being a blacksmith up around Shandon, and around Shandon was called Little Baghdad.
Yeah, yeah. Around John Street, Upper John Street, Lower John Street. There were just so many little cottage industries down there. And I mean, it was real inner city. I often think about it now, even though I've had all my jabs. I think I'm impervious to most of these things because the place was like that stream coming in there was filthy. It was full of rats and there was a slaughterhouse out there and there was the brewery tipping all their stuff into the stream. But it was a hive of activity and characters and everything else. And yeah, Ned Ring was the blacksmith. But he was actually an urban blacksmith. Insofar as he shod, for the most part, some farmers as well, because farmers would come into Murphy's Brewery with their with wort and with their malt and so on,
yeah.
But and barley and so on. But it was mostly the dray horses, the brewery horses. And I remember being a little boy inside what was little more than a rusty corrugated iron shed. And Ned Ring was there. He was a lovely man. And next thing is, one of the boys from Murphy's Brewery would lead in one of the horses, and the whole shed would darken with the size of this creature. And they were so docile. Ned, all he'd do, he used to wear this filthy leather apron and he'd have the thing well reddened, and all he would do was he'd lean over shoulder to shoulder with the horse. The horse was obviously towering above him, but just with a little tap on the fetlock, the big, huge, shaggy hoof would come up and Ned would do his business, and he gave me a go on a few occasions as well. So it was a really colourful inner city upbringing.
But, like, it does seem like another world in a way. And this will bring us to the book now. Like, is it that did things change very quickly then in terms of modernity in the 60s and the 70s? Is really that Ireland that's portrayed in the book wasn't really left behind until then, was it?
Amazingly quickly, because I'm only 18 months older than you. But anyway, yeah. No, what happened was really, when I look back at some of these stories, I realise that the childhoods and the schooling of the 1930s wasn't hugely different in ways to my early schooling as a little boy in the 60s, say, and into the 70s in secondary school. But so like there was corporal punishment, there were cross schoolmasters, there were the same games, picking and all the rest of it. There were inkwells. I started out on a dip pen as well, you know, with the nib and the whole thing. And there was the duster. And a lot of those things have drifted. I often think that nowadays they're bringing laptops and calculators and everything else into exams. Yeah. We'd be leathered within an inch of our life if we thought of doing such a thing. And in fact, I think, Brendan, that goes right back to the Bardic tradition, that whole notion of learning things off by heart. And we did a lot of that. And I used to, you know, say, but brother, why are we learning it by heart when I have it in the book? It was good enough for your ancestors. So that's a muscle that was exercised.
And,
we were
and you know now why it was beneficial to learn it off by heart.
Absolutely.
Too. We didn't learn more off by heart.
Yeah. I wonder how many 20-year-olds or 19-year-olds, and this is no disrespect to them because I probably fall into that category now as well in terms of old knowledge. Like how many people could find their way from Tullamore to Mallow without a GPS? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
not a lot.
Yeah. And funny, when I think I came upon at one point and I found myself chanting in my head up the Airy Mountain and down the Rushy Glen. Those things were bet into us, weren't they?
Well, that wasn't actually bet into me. I learned that from my mom, who loved poetry. She loved Pádraig Cullum and all of those. And when I was a little boy, I think Chicken Pox or something, that was the first poem I learned. It's actually in the book there, up the Airy Mountain, down the Rushy Glen. We daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men. We folk, good folk, trooping all together, green jacket, red cap and white owl's feather. And I fell in love with leprechauns and I actually wanted to get a pet one. I still love leprechauns, always will, world without end.
And listen, the leprechaun stories in it, did semi believe in leprechauns? And like, you know, they've become kind of, we've kind of half turned on them because we think they're stage Irish or whatever, or demeaning to us, but They were kind of a slightly more, would we say, sinister kind of thing or real thing back in the day?
No, I think they were mischievous. I often wonder, Brendan, if there's a connection between a lot of European folklore in terms of trolls, that whole notion of Neanderthal man, of African man making their way across the Mediterranean and arriving in modern-day Europe, I suppose, and discovering these mischievous Homo sapiens who were butty and lived in the forests and were mischievous rather than evil, and that there was, some anthropologists would say, there was a degree of intermarriage as well. But that notion of there being folks, even Jim Morrison had a bit of that, people who live in the woods, these butty boys who were rogues who'd rob all around them and misbehave, and the trolls, the elves, There, what is that connection? I don't know. But
yeah.
The leprechauns I've loved, I've only ever seen them. Okay, I might be scared if I met one, but I still believe in them. And I really think that unless we look after the wild places and keep that memory alive, that we may end up, our future generations may end up having to reintroduce leprechauns to the wild, because I don't hear a word about them anymore. I haven't heard of a sighting for years. Since my dad saw one.
Really, yeah. I wonder. They're obviously laying low, yeah. folk kind of medicine and remedies is another part of it. But then again, like you make the interesting point that I suppose if our parents' generation were kind of the bridge between the Ireland depicted in the book and now, that like I'd remember too, like that there were still plenty of those kind of folk remedies around when we were growing up.
Well, you know something, I think even today, like medicine and health is a combination of both, you know, formal traditional medicine and alternative medicines or complementary medicines, if you will. So the history of folk medicine in Ireland, it's like a real heady mix of everything from medals to doctors to healers, folk cures, holy wells, miraculous medals, pilgrimages. Yeah. And if all else fails, Brendan, you know yourself, a rub of the relic and a flat 7-up and you're sorted, whatever the problem is. So we've had to dip into these things over the years, but I came across some mad ones in the school's collection, things I'd never heard of. Well, there's one brilliant cure for warts, and I thought I knew all the schoolboy cure for warts, you know. But there's one where you take a black slug, you know, the black snail that you'll often see in a path.
Yeah.
Take one of those, rub vigorously against wart, right? Then when you're finished, impale the snail on a large thorn. And that's it. And there's no evidence that it actually works, but you will feel better than the snail. There's no doubt about that. And there are loads of those in Cork. And I'd never heard of this before, but it's documented. And the name of the collector and the Balahore and the informant are given. But in Cork, there is evidence that people used to, for a cold, they would boil a mouse in milk and drink the milk. And there was another one where you would boil, I know, where you would boil, sorry, there's people at home now just looking at that full Irish and going, oh, Jesus, no. And there was another one there as well where it was sheep's droppings boiled in milk and drink the milk again. So all I can say is, there was one amazing one. And God, this is really disgusting. No, maybe I'll just leave this one out. They use the term lizard, but I think they actually mean something else. If you have a lizard infestation, what they would do, I mean, this sounds absolutely ridiculous, but this is given as being a local cure. If you had a lizard infestation, I think that might be some other form of parasite inside you. What they would do is you need four sturdy people to hold the victim or to hold the patient over a frying pan full of food with their mouth agape in an effort to coax the lizard to leave the body.
Oh, okay, yeah. Right.
I mean, don't try this at home, folks, but it's in the book. You can read about it.
But yeah, please. But you see, there were people who would have said put a bit of meat up to get worms out until recently and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
I was thinking. Now, you used the worm word, not me, remember, right? But that's what I thought as well. Maybe that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, but you see, a lot of this stuff then, as you point out, like in terms of religion and stuff like that, a lot of it as well was kind of adapted into the so-called more scientific modern world, really, wasn't it? Like that they didn't kill it off, they just kind of respectabilized it, I suppose. Like sport, for example.
Yeah.
We have hurling now, and generally a fairly well-governed game. Tell me about 50-a-side hurling and Spoobeen.
Well, if to put it in context, now again, as you were saying at the beginning, and it's a very fair point, these children's experience was not hugely different from mine. It was 35 years earlier, but the people they were talking to, some of them actually remembered hedge schools and famines and everything else. So there's one case there. The person in question, the collector, was a Hannah O'Donoghue from Fremount in County Cork, and she spoke to an elderly man called Dennis Foley about hurling and about pastimes in the old days, long before Hannah was born. And he said, this is her account now in her words, she said, hurling matches used to be played in Tully Leas long ago. The men of Fremount used to go up to Tully Leas on some Sundays after Mass. This now was about 40 years before the GAA was founded and the game was standardised. They used to have about 50 men. When they arrived in a big field, it was usually selected. There used to be about 50 of the Tully Leas men also. Jeez. Two men were first selected from each side as leaders. They then tossed for the first call, and the man who won the toss called the best man in his side, and the other man called the best man in his side until all 50 had been selected. The ball was then thrown up in the middle of the field between the men. The ball was about 16 inches in circumference. There used to be no referee or no goalposts, or no sideline. But when the ball went out over one of the fences on either side of the field, it was counted as a goal. They kept playing until it was time to go home. They then used, there used to be about 6 hours playing, and there used to be a score of about 20 goals at each side. 6 hours, 20 goals at each side. This method was very rough, and it was a terrible struggle to get the ball across a fence. The men were so strong, they did not notice hard knocks, and it was usual to have a good fight between the rival players for a finish. At least some things haven't changed anyway over the years.
Yeah, so that was obviously the missing link between faction fighting, as it used to be, and the modern game of hurling there. So,
well, local pride, I think, at the parish level really is where hurling is at its most, you know, intense, and football as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in terms of religion then, and again, this sense of the existing way has been kind of formalised. So a lot of the religious stuff has a fair old element of kind of magic and paganism and cults of saints and miracles and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I suppose it was a bit of a heady mix. I even think, you know, with the greatest respect of my own mum and dad, and they would draw on a lot of traditions, really, while you know, practicing Catholics, I guess. They still believed in pishogues on roads, and my father had a miraculous medal, you know, woman that was good for the hip. Or actually, he was a gas man. I remember collecting from the train on one occasion, and I said, "How are you, Dad?" He said, "Be specific." He said, "How do you mean, emotionally or physically or what?" And I said, "Well, physically to begin with." He said, "You know the Litany of the Saints, that prayer, right?" And I said, "Yeah, I know it." He said, "I have the Litany of the Complaints." He said, "Everything I have rhymes." He said, "I have cracked lips, plastic hips, I have phlebitis, arthritis." He had a whole poem made out like a mantra of his ailments. But I think people did, and probably still do, dip into, you know, very ancient traditions as well as the more modern ones. And even on our TV series, Creedence Atlas, over the years, I've come across loads of sacred sites that are now, say, Christian churches, but just beneath the foundations is something earlier, and beneath that again is perhaps something from Celtic times. So there's always that, I suppose, fusion of all those different belief systems feeding into how we go about our lives, even today.
Yeah, yeah. You were a great man to say the rosary with all the trimmings. What were the trimmings?
The trimmings, gee, yeah. Not unlike my dad, a few of my cousins and one or two of my siblings, I have the talking disease. I just can't stop. Full stops, commas don't exist in my world. And so my father would pick me to say the rosary. He'd always say, "John, good man." So we'd retire to the bedroom, and my father would throw himself down for an hour, and he'd say, "Go on now." He says, "You lead off there, John." So I'd start, and I'd do the Sorrowful Mysteries are the best, actually, and I'd lead off into the. So within a couple of seconds, I could hear my father snoring, sound asleep. This was a break for him, a busy man with 12 children, and my mom as well, between 12 children and work and everything else. But when we get to the end of the rosary, he knew that I'd keep going. That so I'd be saying the Hail Holy Queen at the end, and I'd go on then praying for fallen women and for sale. For sailors lost at sea. I had a prayer for everything. I forget most of them, but I had loads of them. And so that mantra would go on. Like, my siblings hated me, obviously, but that would go on. But you know something? I think back, I was down in the Dojon Bera some time back at a Buddhist meditation. I met a very interesting man, actually, who said to me, "Love Buddhism, but beware of Buddhists." I thought it was a sound piece of advice. But anyway, when I was there and... I remember the rosary. I couldn't stand it when I was a kid, especially down the country where it was said. I used to think, "Oh no, boring, boring. They haven't even got a TV in this house. It's so boring. Come in for the rosary." So we'd all take a chair and kneel down at the chair and it would start. But you have to surrender to it. And I kind of think that's like the boredom portal. It's like any meditation. Eventually the head settles.
Yeah.
But when I was sitting down...
chanting.
So when I was at the Buddhist retreat, I remember, like, and I've been at a few of them, but I go anywhere, try anything, at least once, but I remember sitting outside the Dojon Bera and I could hear whether it was a tape or actually there is not a silent retreat, there is a private retreat going on there as well. And I could hear the sound of Tibetan monks, you know, "Oh, you're home, oh," going on like that. And it kind of brought me right back to my own childhood. And I think I now understand what the rosary was about. It was meant to be boring you. It was meant to take you out of your thinking head and bring you to equilibrium. And so a lot of the old ways actually made sense. I feel, anyway, things that we threw off, you know.
You see, the thing is, it is in a way, and the way you're weaving it together there, even, it's like dipping into the subconscious of our psyche, a lot of the stuff in this book, isn't it? Because it's all still there, woven in there in us in strange ways.
It reveals huge amounts about us, and I'm fascinated, always have been. Maybe it's because of my mother and her love of old Irish poetry, and my dad as well, just my dad's ways. And I loved the old people, and that's my stated ambition, actually, is to become a happy old man, because there are a few things in life I find as reinvigorating as talking to a happy elderly person, someone who's old, who's maybe in a bit of pain, but who loves looking at life and thinks the whole thing is amazing and is still not sure where they're going when they close their eyes. And so there's just so much confrontation in the world. I love hanging out with, always have, even as a little boy. I loved old people and I always wanted to go with things. And I just think that there's... And you know what I discovered in this? When I was doing my research, and I have to say, Josephine Weatherford, who was the researcher, did a lot of the heavy lifting in this for me, was absolutely brilliant. And Christor McCorrig from Dukas, who gave me the key to the safe, because I thought they'd never allow me to do this. I've been a fan of the folklore collection for years. So, but absolutely brilliant. And Josephine, I was actually, a strange thing, I got a note from her yesterday wishing me luck with the book, and she said that she had never known the story of John Twiss. But it was actually in there I came across this man called John Twiss, who was wrongfully hanged. And despite protests from the people and despite a very flimsy case against him, the man was hanged. And so that story went in there under ghost stories, because the story related to a disturbed spirit, let's say, who was haunting a railway line near Limerick and Kerry. And it was the daughter of a man who'd been on that jury that convicted John Twiss. Now, whether this was true or not, it didn't matter, but it was used to keep the John Twiss case alive. So where law had failed them, folklore was keeping John Twiss's memory alive, and that's why I put the story into the book.
And but then lo and behold, all this time later...
Lo and behold, I'm at home, lying on the bed, watching RT News Now, as one does, usually in hotel rooms, but... And next thing, it comes on. President Michael D. Higgins has posthumously awarded a pardon to John Twiss, who was an innocent man and was hanged back in the 1890s unjustly. And his family were there. The relatives of John Twiss were there receiving the official pardon. And I thought, my God, the power of the folklore.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, they were amazing people, I have to say. I love the characters.
And it's great stuff. It really is. Listen, you also found a letter that you wrote yourself to your parents when you were a young lad, and you stuck it into the book as well.
I did, yeah. My sister Nora gave me this. It was with my dad's possessions when he died. It's not that he had much, but in there he had a postcard that I had sent him way back. It's in the book there, and it's when I was staying down in East Cork with this childless couple. She actually worked for us, Bridgie, and Johnny Creedon, although no relation, kind of adopted me as the son he never had, and he was
so mad. Because there were 12 of you, would you be kind of put out for the summer in those days, like?
Hunted. Yeah. Wanted. Get him out of the city, will you? He's looking at girls now, you know?
Yeah. And,
so all my summers were spent. All my cousins were in West Cork. When I went to the North Mon, I was amazed that boys in my class who had cousins who lived in the city. I thought your cousin had to be from the country. So my mom came from Adrigal in the beautiful Beara Peninsula, and my dad from Inchiquila. They came from beautiful places, I have to say. And they were a lovely couple, right up to old age, despite having 12 kids and everything.
I'm told, I know more about your family than you think. I'm told that the Blakes were renowned beauties, your mother's family.
Every boy thinks his mammy's beautiful. But in my case, Brendan, it was true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, she was a stunner, all right. Clearly, I look more like my father's people. But anyway, she, as my old man used to say, God, we're broadened the beam, like the Vikings. But anyway, so my mom, she was beautiful and a gentle and aristocratic. And they were interesting people. I still haven't done a proper search. But they were Church of Ireland, as I understand it. They were Blakes. Like, my grandfather was a William Blake, the same name as the English poet, but yet he was a poor Catholic farmer living on the side of a mountain down in Beara. And he had 10 daughters. My mom had 9 sisters, no brothers. My dad had 3 brothers, no sisters. So you can see the wide attraction between the two of them. But they did. They loved each other. They sang to each other, even in old age and everything. They were just great. But when I was down, dispatched to Johnny Creedon's farm, and they were a childless couple. They had 16 acres, and Johnny had a name for all the animals. Do you know, there was Teresa McGonagall was one of the cows. And I swear to you, but I was left there, and I kind of did a lot of growing up because I was left on the farm all day while Johnny went off driving a bus. And from the time of I was six, seven, eight, I was kind of running the farm on my own, nervous, feeding the calves and hoping the cross pig wouldn't get out of me. And he had a little bit of everything. He had a handful of Landrace sows. He had a couple of German shepherds. He had Mick, who was the cock of the walk, who was another little dog. He had 3 cows, some dry cattle. So I learned a lot about farming, I suppose, as a little boy in the other farms. But I did write him, and I found that my sister gave me the card. But I have to say, this is just so me. Some things don't change. But it was a postcard I wrote home on the 3rd of July, 1967. So I'd have been 7 or 8 at the time. And it was, "Dear Mammy and Daddy, I hope you are fine. Do you know how to kill a hen? Bridgie showed me." S-H-O-D-E. "Bridgie showed me. Get broom and put on floor. Get hen. Thigh his legs together. Place his head under broom. Stand on broom. Grab his legs. Pull hard. Can you bring down my football boots? I miss you. Lots of love, Mr. John Creedon." With a flourish at the end.
You had notions even then, John Creedon.
I had you. "Bring down my boots. I got some hens to kill." Well, anyway, I was even thinking, God, so innocent. Tie his legs together. I didn't even know that a hen was female. Thigh his legs together.
Yeah. Somebody here claiming that they can testify. Declan Bracken says, "I can testify to snail's slime working on warts." Mike says, "Read trolls and leprechauns. Psychics claim to see elemental spirits on astral levels, very similar to trolls, small folk, a.k.a. leprechauns. I saw one myself years ago." Really, Mike. Mike, I think we should put you in touch with John Creedon. The two of you have a lot to talk about.
And you know something, Brendan? There's like the recent census, I thought, what a brilliant idea, putting in that little panel where people can enter whatever they think, like, "My postman drives me mad," signed Mr. Murphy or whatever it is. Yeah. Because that's a snapshot of who we are in the middle of a pandemic. People had a chance to say, that's us. Yeah. That's the new Irish now, 2022. With this one, it's more than just a snapshot. I mean, folklore, Oscailge is Béal Iddis, and it literally translates as mouth instruction. And Iddis is a prescription. It's what you still hand in to the chemist in the Gaeltacht. So Béal Iddis, or folklore, meant mouth instruction, where you learn.
Should we send out the copybooks again now?
Do you know what? It'll be a brilliant idea, and get them to do it longhand if they know, if they still remember. Because I'll tell you, in this case, you know, folklore is usually handed down to us. In this case, it's actually handed up to us. This is children from the 1930s telling us. Yeah. And because they were asking elderly people, I found 2 of my aunts in the collection. And I have to say, I wept, actually.
Must have been very moving, yeah.
It was hugely moving. And I'll tell you why. Because my dad had already said to me how lovely they were. They were, you know, 10 beauties, according to my dad. But of course, my mother was the prize. It's all that way, isn't it? But he said, he told me that Martha, he said, had beautiful handwriting. He said, oh, she was a lovely girl. He said, so quiet. And she ended up keeping the parish records and everything else. But when I searched in the local school, I knew my mom would have gone through. She was born in 1921, so she'd have been 17 at the time of the collection. But I said, I wonder if the younger sister, she was number 7 of 10. And I looked, bang, up they came. The first 2 names in the school were my 2 aunts. And they went on and they lived very difficult lives, actually, but they're now buried together as they were in childhood when they were 10 and 11. And when I read them, it was the beautiful handwriting of Martha. It was almost like my dad was looking over my shoulder with me and saying, see, I told you. And her story, which she wrote several essays, actually, but in one of Martha's, was about Oit Anamnacha. And today we would say Logan Anamnacha, but it means place names. Mm. So there was my own aunt, as they say, Brishan an Dúchas, and my own passion for place names was already there in my aunt's essay back in 1937. And Teresa wrote about famous people in my parish, and there's some great ones in it. There's O'Sullivan Bear, obviously. There was a man who fell off a roof and lived. That was a good one.
And so he's up there. He's up there with Sullivan.
Oh, Sullivan Bear. Oh, Robin Shaughnessy was the best of them. Yeah.
Listen, and it will, that echo you got down the generations, I think a lot of people will get that out of the book in various ways. It's called An Irish Folklore Treasury, and it's out now, and it is a lovely book. John Creedon, author, broadcaster, and Cork Person of the Year 2022. Thank you very much.
Thanks a million, Brendan, and I hope everybody enjoys it. Really, I appreciate this. Thanks.
Okay, see you, John.
Email brendan@rte.ie.